Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and I am so excited to have a wonderful conversation around data exchange. That's exciting? Heck yeah, it's where we're at right now. Data is king, right? The main message that we're going to convey to you, audience, is that common data language lessons outside of construction to use in construction. And what I'm so excited about that, I've been part of Nathan Wood's AEC Integration Summit. And what really spurred this podcast was Andrew has presented, they have all these different threads and conversations going in and out of the AEC Integration Summit. And he did this presentation of around bringing stuff from banking and other stuff that really ties it together of really educating us how these programmers and how this common data language works and how much undertow there is. And the benefit is that Aquifer is an integration and automation platform that allows you to transfer data between the tools you use every day. And if there's one thing I've learned so far of this whole journey is that there is no silver bullet, but we do have to figure out how to break through the ceiling and stop just using email and putting PDFs around and then figuring out how to take these flat documents and the orchestrating this network from all of this flat stuff. But we have to step up and adopt and utilize data exchange. And when we get into that, Andrew had a lot of really good one-liners that we're going to unpack around that about how to be an integrator when it comes to common data language. So that's what I'm super excited about today's conversation. So without further ado, let's get into know Andrew's story, have as much fun as possible. And as we always start, what's your favorite beverage, Andrew?
Hi, Devin. Thanks for having me on. So my favorite beverage is plain seltzer water. By plain, I mean does not have sodium or any minerals in it, just plain good old seltzer water.
So all the hips of all these crazy flavors and all this stuff add to, you just want just the OG, right?
H2O and CO2, yep.
Awesome. Tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
I travel pretty regularly to Puerto Vallarta. So it's a close but still really tropical, nice, really great city to visit, lots of stuff to do there.
Beautiful. Give us one example from being there.
I went with a group of friends, and this was 2021, so like right after COVID, and we had eight of us share a villa, and they're super inexpensive, and you get like an entire house with like small staff and stuff for what you would, you know, normally just be at like a Hilton someplace for. Yeah. So it's really nice, and we were able to go down to this like town park, go to like the nightclubs, the bars and stuff. It's really nice.
I've done the same. I think it was eight couples, and like having the people there making the food and all, like, and it's super cool experience. I love that. Tell us about the favorite hobby or interest that you like to do outside the construction silos we're going to talk about breaking down that we passionately call the art of construction.
I am an engineer, a software engineer, so I do get pretty nerdy. So like sci-fi, all that typical stuff, but I also just like, you know, a lot of YouTube videos about like engineering random things. Sometimes they're ish construction, like how we did a nuclear, you know, built a nuclear thing. But sometimes they're like trains, infrastructure, AI software, et cetera. So I definitely can be a nerd's nerd at times.
Well, I've definitely, as I've got to hear your stories of where you're coming from, is really cool perspectives for people like me that are trying to figure out how do we mine this data and get smart about breaking through the ceiling of all of these different buzzwords out there. So super excited for this conversation, but let's go back to the beginning and you share your story that led you to being the co-founder at Aquifer.
Sure. And so I've been in software and data for quite some time. So I actually had my first software job when I was 16. I worked at a software web company part-time out of high school. Fast forward into college, did part-time stuff, always trying to find ways to make money. So I worked part-time for the university, you know, writing web services for SharePoint, and then keep going. And then out of the bat from college, worked at Penn Medicine doing applications and software for clinical research. Did that for a while, worked for a software company called, at the time, RJ Metrics. which would later become Stitch. That's where I met my co-founder, Matt Monahan. So he had worked there already for several years. He's pretty close to one of the earlier employees. I was a later employee, but we, you know, crossed path there for a couple years. That's where we met, you know, went off. He actually went into construction technology. He had founded a company called Hoist, which was later bought by Voyage Control. He did a bunch of other stuff in construction technology. I went off and did a little stint in government, then consulting, but a lot of it was working in more traditional spaces. So things outside of like the tech bubble, so like tech companies, e-commerce, et cetera. And then we came back and we started talking and we noticed, hey, you know, we're in these more like air quotes traditional spaces, just meaning not tech companies. And, you know, tech companies have all these options, all these capabilities, all this stuff, but outside of it, you're really dealing with a lot of like old guard technology or integration platforms that have been around for decades, or people kind of homebrewing stuff, et cetera. And so we thought there was opportunity there. Because if we try to do the same thing, but for everyone, you know, that's just, it's hard to please everyone. So what do? You find a way to focus. We decided to focus within AECO, so construction, you know, engineering, et cetera, construction and the stakeholders surrounding it. And so that's where our concentration came. And then also on my dad's side of the family, my dad is actually a project manager in construction, and going back a couple generations, all construction and real estate. So like uncle's a mortgage broker, et cetera. So there's actually some experience there. Me and my siblings are kind of different in that we're not in construction, but now I kind of sort of am, even though I have an engineering background. And so we started Aquifer, and that was technically spring of 2021, but I'd actually started working on the code base and a lot of the technical pieces of it in 2020 during lockdown as kind of something to do. So it's a little bit of a lockdown born thing. And then, you know, we started working initially with companies that, you know, he had worked with, I had worked with, because I actually did work with a couple construction companies during my consulting days, and then just kind of kept rolling from there.
I love it. So you grew up like feeling your dad who raised you living construction. Then you went out and you have threads in and out of construction with you and your co-founder. So can you talk about like from the big picture, what is Aquifer, and then really what sectors of construction does it serve? So we can kind of tee up this conversation of who is Aquifer from where Andrew and the team are coming from.
Mm-hmm. So Aquifer, I mean, we're mainly about, you know, kind of, you know, three major areas, but it really comes down to two. So one is if you're a company connecting the software, the tools in your company. So if you're like a general contractor, that's generally like project management system, your accounting system, and maybe scheduling. So like Primavera or MS Project. So those are kind of like the key systems, and you may have a few other ancillary ones too. So getting those all to talk together. Another thing that we enable for those companies is because we're connecting to all their systems anyway, and we can pull data out, the ability to have that raw data for analytics. They can take that raw information coming out of those systems, pump it into like Power BI, Fabric, Tableau, whatever they want to use, they have that data available. And then the third area is what we're trying to get in with the CPC and trying to build out more. It's less mature, but it's probably the longer term thing that's just going to take a lot more effort, which is, okay, if you can get the tools within a company to talk to each other, what about across companies? So how can I get, if someone's on a project management system, how can I get another
wait,
one?
Wait,
another
you mean talking? People in construction have to work together? They don't just need their own thing?
Yeah, they don't just work in a silo together. Yeah. And it's, you know, every company's got to work with their companies, but in construction, there's a lot of, it's like what they call like stakeholder heavy, right? So there's a lot of different, there's, you know, government pieces, there's subcontractors, contractors, owners, rep, architects, there's so many stakeholders, and they all have software and they all have to exchange information. But it's just what really gets me for a lot of the stuff is that you end up with someone has this information structured somewhat well or very well in a piece of software. And then they dump it into a PDF or Excel or something. Then that gets emailed. Then that gets, and then someone's got to enter it into their software, and that happens over and over again. So, you know, it's really a. We already seem to have most of the software there from what people actually use every day. Now it's a, can we get it talking to each other? And so that's where we're kind of hoping to come in.
Yeah, and I think it's so needed. I think there's so many. The word plugins or Nathan and his magnets of like, you know, putting all this stuff together, right? So from your point of view, what is the key to moving data from one platform to the next that we all have realized there is no silver bullet? And then can you talk through, you mentioned a couple names on this on the lead in, but like what players do it best from your point of view as you start the evolution of you and I on the pre-interview was, you know, you start by doing this custom stuff for a client and then you find out you do client 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and you find these common threads of clients all doing to make a out of the box stuff that becomes a software as a service, but then these big companies can come and change. So I'm really curious, what is the key to doing that and who really does that well in this moment of time today and who is staying power for all of us to figure out how to be here tomorrow? And because we have to figure out, you're only as good as your last project in construction. We have to remove that stigmatism of how do we break through the ceiling together and innovate together.
Yeah, so it's and what we kind of found was there's been a lot of attempts to make standards for software to work together for forever, for decades. People have tried to make software work together, and you end up coming up with barriers. And there's several different barriers. A general one is just whoever's making the standard. There's like a famous nerdy XKCD comic book where someone's like, "Wow, there's 14 standards. Someone needs to make the standard that works." There, you know, dot, dot, dot. There's now 15 standards that no one's using. It's adoption is pretty big. So adoption is pretty hard. When they get adopted, it tends to be that either it's the government or some big player adopting it and kind of leading everybody else towards it. The second area is that a standard in general. So we have found that some companies and some people have tried to make a standard work with connecting systems within a company. And what we found is that if someone owns all the systems, like those are their systems, a standard may make them, you know, kind of do the least common denominator. They'd have to do, there's things that they couldn't do. It's like, well, we have to adhere to the standard. So you can't have this field or that field or this thing work. Where if people own their portfolio of software, they tend to want to have a lot more control as far as having, you know, as rich a possible experience as possible. But going across an org, going to another company, when companies have to work together, they have to agree on something. And so I think that that's an opportunity where a standard can work and has worked. Because, yeah, it's going to be more limiting than whatever you want to do with your own software that you control. But you have to do that when you're working with other people that, you know, you don't control their software. They don't control yours. You have to meet somewhere in the middle. And so these standards can kind of work of that. You know, what do we agree upon? How do we do this? And that standard can work within, I think, that arena going across an organization where it's been more difficult within an organization. And then from an adoption standpoint, that's always tough. I think, you know, one of the things that we can do that maybe just a governing body or something couldn't do is that because we're a software company and we specialize in integration, we can actually build the thing. We can make the thing versus just kind of putting a standard out there and hoping it gets adopted.
Can you unpack that a little bit about people like me that don't make the thing and on the outside of understanding who should we pay for and how to make the thing to make our business come together, just from your point of view of all the context that you're coming from of this empirical data, but now working with these big names of Excel and Procore and Oracle and Sage and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So it's, there's kind of two ways that a standard could go and it ends up, it could end up being a combination of both longer term, but really it's either you make a standard, say magic wand standard exists. Okay. It exists. Either you get all of the software companies to somehow adopt it. So there's, what, a dozen popular software companies that do project management systems. You have to get all of them to do it. And, yeah, the top two may or may not do it, but then you still have
the long. When you say those top ones, who are those top ones?
So examples would be things like Procore, Autodesk Construction Cloud, like Kahua, you know, a new form of more for architects. So project management systems, and, you know, probably a half dozen of them make up or even less make up something like 80% of the market. So you might be able to get a good amount of the market integrated, but then you have what they call the long tail problem, which is, well, then there's a bunch of other, there's probably dozens and dozens because there's more specialized ones. There's ones that are used more for GCs versus subs, et cetera. And then that becomes a longer tail, a longer number of systems that have to integrate. And the likelihood that all of them would self, you know, integrate into the standard, et cetera, may happen, but probably wouldn't. That's been an issue with other standards. So like SCIM, which is like a standard for getting user, I only have to provision a user once that all my software magically has my users. It's existed. It's not, it's adopted somewhat well, but not by everyone and not by the majority of people. So getting software companies to somehow all adopt a standard is a possibility, but I think it's not likely to happen or not likely for enough of them to happen for it to work really well. The other way is that you have tools that sit in the middle or multiple tools that sit in the middle that can work with those companies, what are called APIs. They're public ways that programmers, et cetera, can interact with that software. And then we're building the translation and the exchange, the way to move data between these various systems and ultimately the stakeholders, the organizations that have accounts or own these systems. And it might end up being that there's some combination. You know, maybe people end up going with one or more exchanges, plus maybe, say, Procore or Autodesk ends up adopting it. So then for some people, they may just be able to stick in that world, or they go across, or they can use both. That's also a possibility, too. But I do think that either way, you need players like us that can do the exchange work in order for it to be adopted well and work at a scale across as many stakeholders as possible. So you don't end up on a project where only half the people have it or something like that.
Yeah, and I'm listening to, I'm visualizing the long tail and the front end, the 800-pound gorillas of this whole thing to figure out how to have this stuff come together. And what I really want you to unpack for us a little bit is I think the construction people, I raise my hand and say, you don't know what you don't know, and boy, you can be jaded by what you think you know. So a guy like me, that when I say my little bubble of spending 25 years in supply chain around windows and doors, we have these nuances of these window manufacturers, of plugins to that, and we're all adopted to those type of things that are not even part of the tail of what you just talked about. But it all filters back into how you fit into these big construction projects, or maybe you don't do those at all. So you don't even, you're not even paying attention to this stuff because you're where you're up and downstream. But the part that I've been realizing is, you know, we had Chad with Plexus and Charlie Dunn of these different things talking through of like up and in and out of this AEC integration summit with Nathan Wood of like, what is the biggest problem and how do we all come together to solve it? And I've been hearing a lot about we have to take from other industries that have really big players like oil and gas or banking of different things that you gave this presentation at a previous one. And there's a lot of light bulb moments for me of just when you hear something inside of banking to how we could correlate it to the future of construction and put all this stuff together. So can you give some example from other industries or places that you've worked of points of view for help us break through the ceiling together and all come together as the art of construction and not be the MFers that you think of in construction? We're the master facilitators actually saying there's no such thing as common data language, but we're going to make it for this project.
Mm-hmm. So there's examples of other industries where they have standards and it's worked. They're not perfect by any means, but it works. So like banking, for instance, EDI is used pretty heavily in banking. So is ACH, but that was kind of an example of the government coming in and doing something and the government runs the ACH. But EDI, so like ACH and banking, if I go into my, you know, bank online thing and I put someone's routing number and account number in and I say send them $100, that goes to the ACH using that routing number and accounting number. And the ACH was pretty much inspired by how physical checks worked, right? Because physical checks had a routing number and an account number. And then they just made an electronic version of that. EDI was a little different. That came in the late 80s and is still pretty, very prevalent today, where that's about, okay, that's exchanging a number to an account, but how do I know whom the payer is by name? How do I know details of the transaction? That's where EDI can come in and either initiate that or how that information can be exchanged. And so EDI is also used by particularly like logistics. So like if you're a supplier for like CVS or Walmart, you hook into like an EDI network, and there's some private ones like IBM Sterling and others, or they can kind of run their own where Walmart's so big hey, you need to directly interface with us, but they're exchanging these EDI messages. And these EDI messages kind of look like documents, like electronic versions of documents you'd almost exchange yourself. So like there's a PO one, there's an invoice one, there's shipping manifests to announce a shipping. There's these a bunch of these different, what they call documents, but essentially messages that can go back and forth between systems. The American healthcare system, particularly insurance claims and Medicare claims, use EDI. And so, hey, I want to make a claim inquiry. There's a claim inquiry request, a claim inquiry response. I want to actually make a medical claim. There's a medical claim request, a medical claim response. And so those all use EDI X12, which is the American standard. There's also an international standard, UNIFACT. And so those have been around for a long time. They were invented in the 80s, but they really started being more used widely in the 90s and early 2000s. And a lot of that was, one, the federal government saying, hey, with Medicare, you've got to use EDI X12 to exchange Medicare information. If it's already being used for Medicare, then that pushes private and other insurance companies to use it as well. And then with shipping and logistics, Walmart wanting to use EDI and some other substandards to it, like AS2, these other standards associated with it, saying, hey, if you want to deal with Walmart, you've got to use this, and a bunch of other similar large companies saying, hey, you can't send us paper anymore, or PDFs, or, you know, just dumps into email. You've got to send us these electronic formats so that our systems can automatically ingest it, plan it, et cetera. And that's just at those scales required. You know, they're so big that if they had to handle that much PDFs, let alone paper, it'd be enormous. And those, you know, examples all have different. So in healthcare, they use what they call clearinghouses, but essentially it's an exchange. It's, if I'm a doctor, I don't want to have to integrate with 80 different health insurance companies. I want to integrate with one who then integrates with them. So I send it off to an exchange and then that moves. Same with like that IBM Sterling or other EDI private networks where I don't, if I'm a supplier and I'm supplying, you know, 50 different retail stores, or I'm one of those retail stores and I have hundreds of thousands of suppliers, I don't want to have to integrate with each individual one. I integrate with an exchange. We're all based on a standard. And then the data can go through the exchange, almost sort of like computer networking, right? Like my laptop doesn't have to be directly connected to every computer in the world. I use a network to exchange information with other computers, so I don't have to have a direct connection to everything. So that's where an exchange comes in. It establishes more like a network or exchange pattern. And there's examples of it being used. And then another quick example is FHIR, which is, so that we're not only talking about 80s technology. FHIR is like 2015-ish is when it started. And that's a much more modern version for healthcare. That's like based off of, you know, modern standards and, you know, the internet existing, et cetera.
So I hope you're all like me when he's explaining all this. It really helps get context to where there's so many things where you could take parallels of these exchanges into construction, right? Like, you talked a lot about, at the end of the day, what are we trying to do? We're trying to take our health and wealth and provide shelter, right? And so like all those things, in my opinion, tie in together, but then it gets really overwhelming. And then people get frustrated when it gets overwhelming, right? So what I want you to talk about is now kind of the aquifer data exchange and how you're tying it into the Construction Progress Coalition, i.e. how you and I met through Nathan Wood, and why you attend the AECI Summit and why others should attend.
So we discovered the CPC, I guess, a couple of years ago, and last year was my first time at the summit. And, you know, we're coming as a software or tech company. So for us, the main draw there is that we get to interact with, talk to, and try to work around these topics with people from the industry in a good mix. So it could be, you know, subcontractors, GCs, owners, other software people and software people like, you know, like Newforma specializes in architecture, which is different than maybe Procore, which is more general. And so it's like good to have conversations with different kinds of stakeholders, different kinds of other tech people, and try to come together. And like last year, the topic that I was focused on, like they have little breakout sessions that are like more workshop oriented. So you're not just kind of sitting in a hall and someone's talking to you for an hour at a time.
As Nathan corrects me when I say conference, he's like, no, this is not a conference. This is a summit that we're in different round tables, all exchanging information instead of one way listening.
Mm-hmm. And so our kind of exchange to use the word exchange too much. Our conversation was centered around my specific conversation that I was participating was centered around RFIs. And so that's one of the items that we would like to exchange. So we started both the CPC and us started looking at RFIs in particular and submittals because they're already something that's like forced to go between organizations and there's a lot of expectations around them compared to maybe just notes or something like that. And so we focused on that and it was good to get, you know, feedback from different stakeholders, like something that like a big question is like, okay, why an RFI versus just sending someone an email? And so the answer we basically got was, well, an RFI is official. There's rules about it, typically in a contract. It's considered more of like a legal documentation than just I shoot someone a text or an email and have an unofficial conversation. So it's like, why do you have to have an official conversation? It's like, this is why it needs to get documented. So when we look back, we know, you know, why was this question asked and we can look for things. And, you know,
why obviously boils down to the frustration of projects or, you know, when they're over budget and exchanging and problems and attorneys and all that stuff is the official part of it. That mm-hmm. What I love about this group is that you have all these stakeholders that are talking hypothetical, but they live it in a real world of like, how do we get past these problems to move forward of, but looking into the riches of the niches of what is one of those things that requesting for information of, we do that constantly. And we're always waiting, you know, how many times on a project if it's like, if I could just get everybody to come together and just have a conversation, we could do this instead of 50 different documents people aren't reading. It's really the chicken or the egg of the RFI debate, right?
Mm-hmm. And so that's like the interesting things you get from stakeholders are the real world, you know, tie-in and you know, why does this matter versus that? And why do people tend to do something this way? I would say a good thing that having some tech people there are things like, there were some questions around like, oh, we really don't like doing this. Why do we have to do this part? Maybe. And it was like recording whom is doing each action. It's something, well, the computer should just do that. You actually shouldn't have to do that. There is a difference to it being on a computer versus like a Word doc or something. And that piece of software probably should be trying to minimize the amount of stuff you have to actually enter into this thing.
Totally. And so, like understanding the triggers of where the human can really, you know, exchange it and where the computer can be a guide.
Yep. Or even something we brought up was like, what if we recorded, we enabled the a way for the record the history or something like that, because a question was like, well, what if there's a change or an edit and how do we know that? And I think the more, you know, layman stakeholders are there like, well, we don't have to want to record that. And it's like, well, the computer should just do that for you. You shouldn't actually have to do that. The computer should just be doing that for you. So I think it's also good to have some tech people there. And also, I don't like to think of problems from a technical standpoint from the start. It's like, can we think about this from a real world perspective, then introduce, you know, any technical things and see, you know, from that perspective. So you don't want to limit yourself out the bat from something like a technology piece. So I think that's also important that the tech people also don't get too into it. So it's a balance. And I think we had a pretty good balance last year. And that's just something we have to keep in mind as we bring in these different types of people and different, you know, backgrounds and different types of stakeholders, taking each thing into account and keeping everything in balance.
Yeah. And at the end of the day on the pre-interview, you're like, you know, the world is run by people who show up. Your comment, mm-hmm. you said that was just so much truth to that of like how we're going in and out of the room together and then going out into these separate rooms. One of the challenges that I'm really pushing is to have the art of construction to be a guide of when you're going in and out of these focus groups, how do you tie it all back together, right? So how do you begin with the end in mind of like all these, like last year I was in the Dude, Where's My Fab, but I was also doing all the podcasts. So I was jumping in and out of that. And it really boiled down to like, to have offsite, non-site construction of building it offsite, you really have to have all the stakeholders come together. And then we had the same conversation you had of like, how do you not just be throwing people under the bus and have the right humans and data exchanging that information, which Nathan has been our master facilitator, kind of pulling all that together for many, many years. And then finding, and it, what's really cool is that you have multiple Andrews and people representing brands like Aquifer that are these different, you know, integration providers, and figuring out how do we all be full service together it's really a challenge, right? Of like being, you know, putting a brand on what this files or accounting or project management or scheduling or digital twins or cloud storage, making that vanilla versus a brand, because it's hard at the end of the day. These people lead these brands and then they get scaled, right? And a lot of it now is being swallowed up by big brands, to where I'm assuming a lot of what Aquifer does is it may have worked in the past and now it doesn't. And now you're trying to figure out how to push it forward.
Yeah, yeah. So I think from, you know, CPC standpoint, like you said, the world is won by those who show up. So we literally have a table when we have these discussions. So come get your seat at the table. You know, if you are interested in these topics and you want to see improvement, you will be sitting there and talking with the product managers of all these software companies. You'll be talking to people like us. You'll be able to talk to peers, see what they're, what have they done in this area? Have they been noticing some of the same things? So it's an opportunity to actually talk to all those stakeholders I just mentioned, are also there for you to network with and talk to, give your opinion in front of them, etc. So it is an opportunity to affect the change that you might be looking for.
I love that. Could you give a couple examples, or what we always talk about, getting into the riches and the niches of, could you give a couple case studies of how different construction partners have grown with Aquifer?
Sure. So taking a look, like there's an energy company, Blue Wave, that they use this quite extensively, and they would be considered an owner. So we do work with owners, GC subs. But when we work with an owner, it's typically through, we come in from the angle of, okay, they're doing construction. And if you, as you can imagine, a solar energy company, they're doing a lot of construction now. And so how can they best make that more and more efficient, you know? And so, you know, we're integrating, you know, Procore with their accounting system, and we're integrating, ArcGIS, which is essentially like a digital, twin slash mapping tool, so that they can get all the data from these other systems in there and pulling in, you know, when projects get kicked off by their CRM, et cetera. So, and then on top of that, they're running Power BI on top of all that. So, like they're an integration hub in the owner space. And then we have, like another GC Oakland, where we've integrated a couple systems, and on top of that, so like their workforce planning, Procore, and then on top of that, analytics as well. So there's a lot of both analytics and integration being used simultaneously, and that can also help inform the other, because once you start to analyze the data, how do you go about improvements in process? Often integration tends to be a piece of that.
I love that. Could you just give us a few of kind of like the best use cases today of kind of a call to action of what people should be thinking about, of where they should be using tools like Aquifer?
Sure. In an ideal world, all of your company systems are talking to each other. And so what that can mean is the very obvious, you know, instances are you doing double data entry? Are you exporting from Excel then loading into another one? Are you even manually entering it? That's kind of the easiest first pass, is just get rid of that. You shouldn't be doing double data entry. You shouldn't be, you know, copying stuff off of a PDF between your different systems. So that's the main thing that we eliminate. And then from there, once you have things integrated, as you start to look at your own business processes, you may start to see, hey, when we kick off a project, we actually want a lot of like every single system to have the project, and then based off of different values, you know, start to kick off different records in each system. And then, you know, as I make improvements, so as I like analyze, hey, you know, we found that as we were doing timesheets in the field and we started to put them together, we made all these requirements around data entry, but we actually found out that a couple of them don't really occur enough. Do we maybe just want to stop recording them and making everyone do them? And we also noticed that a couple data points are actually in another piece of software. Why don't we just ask that piece of software for that bit of system? So also as you, you know, integration also kind of almost leads to more integration, because as you start to get that feedback loop, you start to see more opportunity.
Yeah, I love that. Integration leads to a lot more integration, as I've learned of doing deep dive podcasts with several people at like Trimble about the robot dog, to this, to Esri of GIS and all these different things of brands that you work with, of the whole, the statement of it sounds so good, of single source of truth, but there's so much integration of the integration to make that all happen, right?
Yep. And a lot of integration is also about people. Like it's a huge amount of the work is not just the technical aspect. It's that each one of these systems is usually kind of owned by someone or literally owned by someone within the org and working with everyone. So there's also a lot more of a people aspect to it than people may think.
I love that. So what are the key items when working with a data integration partner to think about?
So if you're working with a partner, so we do consider ourselves an integration partner, meaning we're both a platform plus professional services. We also work with other partners that do some similar professional services with our platform. So really it's expertise and experience, I think, is a pretty big one. Both in construction itself, but with some of these systems or similar ones, I would say sometimes people come to me with, a piece of software that they're using and we've never integrated with before because there's 100,000 business pieces of software. We can't have experience with all of them. But I think they kind of ask, oh, do you have experience with the system? And I would say it's more important that they have experience with integration than a particular system, because there's lots of people that have experience with the system but have no idea, like, how would you integrate data with it? What are the general, good rules of thumb for integrating data? What are the steps you have to take to do it well? The pitfalls that can happen and being aware of those. So I'd say experience with integration in general, if you're dealing with more legacy systems, that they've worked with some more legacy systems, doesn't have to be the same one, but just there's been experience there. And then from a software standpoint, so we designed and made our own software versus if you're licensing another software and just providing services on top of it. So at a core, we're a software company more than a professional services company. So we think that's a plus. We can control that platform, as in particularly when dealing with some of these older systems or more difficult, even newer systems, if there's a bug or something, we're not waiting around for a month or two for the downstream technology partner to make a change. We can make the change directly ourselves.
Yeah, and that's the chicken or the egg, right? If you're building this whole new tool and it's hard to switch from one to the next, like how do you bridge that gap? Or maybe you shouldn't at all. You should be integrating them together, right? And so there's a lot of moving parts that you got to figure out. At the end of the day, a lot of it I've heard from you is that you better understand how to manage your business, but you better know your numbers. And that's what you kept saying, bolting onto the top of Power BI or this or that to help, the decision makers move the business forward every day. So as we work to close this thing out, Andrew and I will both be, I just booked my hotel room at the Otis last night and finalizing all my plans that, some days can be long and the years are short. And I love how Andrew says you got to show up. And these are the type of people that are part of the Art of Construction Master Facilitators through Nathan and the Construction Progress Coalition, all showing up at the AEC I Summit 2025. But the questions we always ask on this global megaphone of pulling it all together, that I love to ask this question when I get to talk to a person who's been in construction technology for a while. Andrew, what is your crystal ball for the future when it comes to technology and construction?
So it's not chatbots. So I think AI will have, AI here being generative AI that has a chat interface, because it could be really broadly interpreted, but that's what's popular now, right? And it's being thought of, it's going to revolutionize everything. I think it's going to have an impact, but it's not going to be this panacea that people think it is. Really what probably would have to be a big thing in construction would be if robotics can really move us. There's some interesting things happening there, but we're not at a point where we're replacing laborers with robots. So the question would be is, okay, on maybe a 5 to 15 year scale, are we going to see robots where they're making really big impact on labor? Cause labor is the biggest, if you look at, and there's a really great Ezra Klein New York Times article on this, but essentially if you look at all the different industries since the 1970s, all of them productivity's shot up because of technology. Construction's been pretty stagnant. Part of there's a lot of different aspects about that. One is the permitting process is more complicated. There's now more community input that's required. Safety, which is a good thing, but safety is also, you have to do more with safety. So there's things that are bringing down that productivity. But they're all related to mostly physical things. So is a chatbot going to improve those sorts of things? maybe the permitting side, maybe it can help with some of that. And maybe, you know, data exchange, I think, can help in the back office. And so you get some incremental changes there. But for these big shot changes that people are looking towards, I think that's where, how are we reducing the amount of and making more efficient physical labor and the movement of physical things? And that gets into, is there robotics? Is things more modular? If we have more robotics and modularization, do we then have to have more software and integration? Do we have to? So it kind of comes back to, chatbots are cool, they will have an impact, but what's going to make it so that, you know, labor and movement of physical things, maybe it's not labor, but we are in a physical realm, this isn't services or something. How are we going to improve those aspects?
Totally agree. As a guy for 25 years, the windows and doors just keep getting bigger and bigger and impossible to move, but we just keep doing it the same way. And so at some point you have to recognize the definition of insanity is there's not enough people to go around, and the ones we have are breaking down, right? And so we have to really figure out how to work smarter, not harder. The final question we always ask, Andrew, is what is that one thing you want to leave our builders and affiliates to go out there and crush it and grow their business that we call the AOC MFers, not the MFers that you think of construction, but the master facilitators all banding together and showing up at places like the AEC Integration Summit. And if you can't, listening to this podcast, Kindling, and taking action in the show notes of this podcast to go build better buildings. What's that one thing you want to leave them with to go out there and crush it and grow their business?
So I'd say a lot of people probably try to sell you software, and you already probably have a lot of software. So part of what I like integration, but I think you can do with and without integration, is using your own software, the software you already have, more efficiently. So as we kind of mentioned, things like, can you get rid of some double data entry? Can you get them more connected? How can you use them more efficiently? And that doesn't sound as sexy, but can often have pretty big improvements from an efficiency and cost perspective, because you're using what you already have, maybe adding a little incremental cost, but getting a better ROI overall of your entire like IT portfolio.
Absolute gold. As a guy that's been living it, we'll make sure we put Andrew's contact information in the show notes for you to go check out Aquifer and get in touch with him. Andrew, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. It's an honor to get to know you better. Through, you know, you and I were both at the conference last year. I raised my hand and say, I don't think you and I talked last year, but we got to know each other throughout the year from this commonality platform. But I'm so excited to give you a cheers and have as much fun as possible with you in a few months in Austin.
Of course, and thanks for having me, Devin.